and Serenade No. 1 by Brahms. For more information, call 333-6280.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us, and we're pleased to have back one of our regular guests, Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She's an obstetrician and gynecologist. She teaches at the U of I College of Medicine and has a practice here in our area, and once a month, always on a Monday, she's here to talk about women's health. Questions are certainly welcome. I know she will do her best. One of the things I always try to remind people when we have physicians on the program is that we cannot diagnose over the telephone. There are certain things the doctor can't do because she can't see you. But I also don't want to discourage anyone from calling. We do these programs to add to your store of health knowledge. So this might be a place to start to get a little basic information. Then, of course, if you have concerns, you want to pursue those with your own doctor or one who can see you. So, having said all that, the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning.
There are a number of things that you brought along that we could talk about. Where do you want to start?
I thought we would start with the news story about the return of the Today contraceptive sponge.
Oh, okay.
It's bringing a lot of press, and the company that is going to bring it back states they have intense internet queries and so forth and calls even about its return. You may remember that the contraceptive sponge is an essentially disc-like structure that's made of a plasticky feeling, spongy material, and it was impregnated with non-oxynol 9. So if you put it underwater and kind of rubbed it a little bit, it got foamy. You slip it in, and it's about the size of a very flat tangerine or something, about that round. And it provided contraceptive protection for over 24 hours. It didn't have any hormones, and you just dispose of it when you're done. And it was fairly affordable. It satisfied both the requirements of having protection against getting pregnant as well as protection against getting a sexually transmitted infection, because the spermicide is also a viricide and bactericide. And it was an extremely popular method. It's been gone from the U.S. market for about 10 years now, or maybe over 10 years now. And the problem with it was that American Home Products, who made the sponge, found some problems with their manufacturing process, and they made an economic decision that it would cost them so much more to retool their plant versus what they thought they could earn in marketing the product. They abandoned it. And it's been taken over by another pharmaceutical house, and their name happens to be Allendale Pharmaceuticals. And this group has actually been negotiating the process of getting a plant going and getting through the FDA approval process, and it's taken them all this time. Sponges are available elsewhere in the world, and I believe they've been brought back in Canada for a while as well. But they finally are up and ready to go, and the FDA has approved them through all the final stages, and we're hoping to see them on the shelves relatively soon.
So compared with other methods, what level of protection does this give you?
You know, contraceptive effectiveness is one of these funny things. The easiest way to explain to patients as to how effective a product is to describe what's called the Pearl Index. And the Pearl Index is something that if we look at 100 individuals using the method for one full year, how many people are pregnant at the end of that year? And that seems to make sense. Now, contraceptive researchers feel that that's not the best method, that actually what people should know is in any given month, using the method versus not using the method, how fertile were you without a method? Somebody 40 is going to be a lot less fertile than somebody 20, say. How fertile would you be if you weren't using the method, and how protected are you if you are using the method? But that's such a complicated formula that even the FDA on contraceptive approvals does not require it, although researchers in this area like myself feel that this method is probably the better. So with Pearl Index, we usually quote in a perfect use situation that failure rates are a little bit less than in what we call the typical use situation. So perfect use being research, studies where you have to report in and you have to track whether you're correctly following instructions. You get thrown out of the study if you're not following it. And typical use out there in the real world. Yeah. So that in perfect use, for instance, a birth control pill should be 99% effective. And at the end of the year, maybe one patient should conceive on that method. In typical use birth control pill studies, we have problems talking about full year effectiveness because at least 35% of people aren't still using the method at the end of 1 year. So what do you do with those people? But if you look at people who do make it to the end of 1 year, probably typical use birth control pill success rates are something like maybe only 3 to 4 people out of 100 are pregnant instead of the one person that we should expect, or less than one person in perfect use. With the sponge and with other barrier methods, perfect use and typical use tend to be a little bit closer because people usually do stay with the method a little bit longer, but probably the typical use failures are about 10 to 12 people at the end of 1 year will be pregnant. So not as good, obviously, as a birth control pill. These are looking at it as an isolated method. Since the sponge left the market, we now have the morning after pill and lots of access to the morning after pill, though you probably have heard there have been a number of situations where people don't have access to the morning after pill. But if there was some problem with the delayed insertion of the sponge or expulsion of the sponge or using the sponge past its 24 hours or something like that, if you back that method up with a morning after pill, probably the success rate would skyrocket.
So let me ask one more question about the sponge. Is this something that you have to have a prescription for?
No, and that is another real benefit. You can just walk into any pharmacy that does carry contraceptives and pick up this method.
And is there anything in the way of contraindications? Any? So here there's the possibility if you just want it, you just go in and buy it. Is there anyone that comes under that heading and say, well, maybe if these things apply to you, maybe you should not use this?
Well, there are. And the major contraindication will be an allergy to the spermicide nonoxynol 9. Mm-hmm. And I think I've talked about this over the years on our radio show. Unfortunately, in the United States today, we only have one spermicide, and it's nonoxynol 9. And it comes in creams and gels and films, and soon it will come back in the form of impregnation of the sponge. But nonoxynol 9 is our only spermicide that we have. And again, this is probably economic. There are some other spermicides that are marketed worldwide. Some of the research has gone a little bit away from, just to digress from the sponge contraindications for a second, but some of the research has gone away from nonoxynol 9 and its contraceptive effectiveness and looking at its microbicide properties, in other words, the ability to protect against picking up an infection. And now there's a lot of work in bringing other microbicides to the market, and I think we will see some of them in the next 5 to 10 years, and that's my guess. But really, there's almost no work in the area of spermicides, and I think because it's a very expensive product to develop and not a very high market index and profitability, I don't really understand all those things. There probably are some women who have had many children who might have a problem with sponge fit and retention, but that's not usually a problem for the average user. And if you had any discomfort, and then there's the question of whether you can overuse the sponge. If you use it on a day-to-day basis, would it be too irritating as a method for you? And that has some consideration, but for the average user, there's very few contraindications.
Okay. Our guest this morning in this first hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She's an obstetrician and gynecologist. She teaches at U of I Med School. She has a practice in our area. She is here once a month, and we talk about women's health. And she has some other things to talk about, but also we are here as a resource for you. So if you would like to call in and ask questions, talk about something in particular, and it needn't be one of the things that she talks about. It could be anything, as long as it's it falls within her area of practice. So the number to call would be 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. What do you want to talk about next?
Well, I thought I would talk about a couple of nutrition topics because mm-hmm. nutrition has been in the news quite a bit. And a new company called Vincent Foods has released the first pregnancy food bar. And it's really a fascinating new concept. And I know my pregnant moms before have asked me whether or not there are any food bars that are specifically designed for pregnant women because, like the rest of us, they're busy, they're on the go, and they often get hungry. In fact, the counseling for pregnant moms usually recommends that you break your meals up into smaller portions and eat more like 5 or 6 meals a day rather than just the 3 meals or in some cases 2 meals a day that many Americans eat. And there was no such thing. And with in mind the kinds of nutrients and minerals that we look at being in prenatal vitamins and the kinds of nutrients that we know are best for babies' brain development, they've come out with a new food bar, and it's going to be called Oh Mama. Kind of interesting. And I did consult on the nutritional content a little bit. I cannot take credit for developing it, though, however. And one of the very important things is that it has one DHA, which is one of the omega-3 fatty acids that we recommend in our diet. And it's high in certain diets that are fairly high in fish, which a lot of us tell our moms that you can't eat too much over-the-counter fish because of the concerns we've talked about with mercury. I can get back to that in a second. But it's one of the few foods that's actually supplemented with DHA. And some prenatal vitamins have looked at DHA supplementation. But other than radically changing your diet, this will be one of the few foods you can actually pick up and eat and get that important omega-3 fatty acid supplementation. And we know that that is good for baby's brain development. So it's kind of exciting. It's an alternative, a healthy alternative.
Okay. I think one of the things that you were thinking, maybe talking a little bit about, is the new food pyramid. And this is one of those things that I think over time we have nutritionists and people like that that are trying to get good information out to people in a way that they can understand about what is a healthy diet. And it gets controversial because people are in the business of producing food, certain kinds of foods. They're, you know, they have their own agenda. They like to have their product presented in an appropriate way or what they consider to be, you know, a positive sort of way. So in the past, there have been periodic attempts to redesign this thing to try to make everybody happy, to satisfy people who are food producers, to satisfy people who are into public education and wanting to get across those ideas. And I'm not sure anybody has ever been happy all the way along. And now we have a new attempt at doing this. And it seems that the same sort of concerns are raised, particularly from people who say, do we now have something that your average person can really understand and make use of?
Well, I downloaded one for everybody in my family. As I said, I was going to download you one, but I ran out of time. But I think that to build awareness, we should tell everybody they can go to myfoodpyramid.gov and they can download and put in their couple of things. They ask you your age. They ask you whether you're male or female. And they ask you about your average exercise per day. And there's 3 categories of exercise, basically none, 30 to 60 minutes, and over 60 minutes a day. And then when they print it out, it's no longer looks like a food pyramid. It looks like just columns that tells you how much you need in the categories of grains, vegetables, fruits, milk, meat, and beans. And under milk is really a focus on calcium rich. And under meat and beans, it just says go with lean protein. So this is definitely an improvement. It made no sense to have people from wildly varying ages and exercise levels and nutritional issues like the old, you couldn't have the same food pyramid for meat eaters and non-meat eaters. And with this, you can actually use the same pyramid. And so I think it's a big leap ahead. I wouldn't say that it's entirely understandable for the average person, but if you start surfing the site, it will give you a lot of information. And of course, there's tons of nutrition information on the internet and in books and libraries. But for instance, in grains, it says 6 ounces of grains. And I still think that it might be a little bit difficult to figure out how many ounces, you know, what's a piece of bread, mm-hmm. and so forth. Yeah. And so I think that that's going to be a problem. I do think that over and over and over again, it has some startling improvements. For instance, under fruits, it specifically says go easy on fruit juices. And I think this is very important because the way many juices are sold in the United States, they are so packed with extra sugars that it's a source of too many calories for many of us, although they do taste very good. And it's also been linked with the rising incidence of diabetes in the United States. So they've got a few things like that in bold, and that's very understandable, that they put across the board. And then they give you a total calorie count. Now, the government needs things like this because they plan meals for school children. They plan meals in programs like prisons and so forth all over this. And it's very, very important. They need some sort of guidance as to where to go. I think that the biggest complaint is that all of us have, you know, a party to go to, a birthday to go to. Maybe we want to go out and have a couple of drinks. And what are we supposed to cut out? What are we supposed to add? How many days a year can we do that and still have an overall healthy diet? And some of those reality checks just aren't in here. Mm-hmm. And of course, this diet is more light on the proteins, where there's been so much emphasis on a higher protein diet. And it really doesn't. It doesn't necessarily address active weight loss.
Yeah. Well, I know I'm looking at mine now. I went to the website. I'm looking. I think one of the things that probably is good, that when it tells you how much of these things that you're supposed to have, I think it's putting it in a way that people, it's easier to understand because it doesn't talk about servings. And I think there was a place where people looked at it saying you're supposed to have a certain number of servings in grains and vegetables. And I'm sure a lot of people said, well, what does that mean?
Right.
And this may be – now, this is putting it in terms of ounces and cups, so it's probably – you can get a better idea of how much of that thing that actually you're talking about.
So if you'd
about.
Be willing to tell me, how many calories did they assign you?
2,400.
2,400. So if you had to eat 2,400 calories tomorrow, how would you split those up?
I'm not really sure. I guess I would have to think more deliberately about what it is, because as I look at what it is that's telling me that I should be my daily intake, I'm sure that I probably eat more than this much beans. Meat. 6.5 ounces from the meat and bean group. That's a tiny six. You know, if you gave me a 6 ounce steak, I'd say,
so,
okay, that's nice hors d'oeuvre, but what are we having for dinner?
And that's the problem. And you look off across the desk like you've done a good job with your calorie counting. But this is another thing. For a 2,400 calorie diet, what I usually suggest to my patients, now most women are going to be assigned much, much lower calorie levels than that. So let's just maybe say, for instance, here I have one of my young patients, and she's actually assigned 2,000 calories. So I would tell her that a good snack is probably 100 calories, like an apple could be even as much as 100 calories, or maybe a low-fat yogurt could be up to a couple of hundred calories. So I would tell her to plan to get somewhere between, if she had a yogurt as her morning snack and an apple as her mid-afternoon snack, that's about 300 calories in your snacks. So now you're down to about 1,700 calories. I like to tell my patients, excuse me, to get a breakfast of 200 to 300. A lot of patients tell me they skip breakfast, and we go round and round about that. But if she actually ate 300 calories at breakfast. Now she's got 1,400 calories to play with. A big sandwich is probably somewhere between 400 and 500 calories. Mm. So if she had a sandwich and maybe some low-fat chips or something like that, she's probably going to eat about 600 calories for lunch. And so she would get about 800 calories, if I've done my math right, for dinner. And if she was going to have a glass of wine that evening or a beer or a couple of beers with dinner, now she's going, or in the evening, she's going to have to, that might be 150 calories each. That could be up to 300 calories. That, well, if you're going to go out for a couple of beers, you can only have a 500 calorie dinner, which is about 450 calorie, or most of those dinner size, pre-made.
Like lean cuisine.
Likely.
Or something like
that. I wasn't going to say
not to mention
a brand.
Any, not to mention
but,
any particular brand. Yeah.
Because there are many good brands out there. But so, you know, you start thinking about that, and some patients really like to be focused on every calorie, but some don't. But I still think that using those general calorie guidelines still do help. And then you've got to go from there and fit these different, okay, how many of these calories are grains and what types of grains and how often. And one of the things that I try to talk to my patients about is food variety, and that really probably isn't healthy to have only one thing for breakfast every day and only one thing for lunch. You know, those of us that went for years only eating peanut butter and jelly for lunch. But, and I could try to convert people from eating it on bread to eating it on rice cake, something like that. But I think there's so many more steps in this that you need to go through to figure out how to translate this information into food. And whether or not you should add in vitamins is a common question that I get as well. And again, these calories are based on maybe a moderate amount of exercise. So maybe you want to print out your pyramid with very low exercise and very high exercise in a particular day. And that's what I tell people, their exercise balances out their dessert. But that they shouldn't figure their general exercise calories in their everyday calories, because so many of us skip the exercise step.
All right. Well, at any rate, if you want to figure out yours, it's www.mypyramid.gov. And that's the website. And there's information on the new food pyramid. And then there's a place where you can plug in some basic information about yourself. I think all it asks is, it asks for your age, it asks for your sex, and it asks a question about physical activity. Only those three things that you have to put in there. And then it prints this thing out, and it gives you recommendations about how much of each of the things, grains, vegetables, fruits, milk, meat, and beans, how much of each of those things you should have on a daily basis. It recommends a daily calorie intake, and then a little bit more information about things like, you know, giving you some advice on how to think about these things. So if you have internet access, you can go and you can check that out. We are about at a midpoint here. Let me just reintroduce for anybody who might be listening. We're talking this morning with Dr. Suzanne Troopen. She is a professor of obstetrics gynecology at U of I Med School. She has practice here in our area once a month, always a Monday she is here, and we talk about women's health. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455.
And I thought I would talk a little bit about pregnancy-related nutrition, since we talked about the bars and just our general food pyramids. But also, and I mentioned this, they want you to limit your consumption of large fish to no more than twice a month, like swordfish. That's very little, I know, because of mercury exposure. And they also recommend that you avoid foods that might possibly have listeria transmission. And it's something that I remember when I was a resident in Los Angeles, I used to see cases of. And since I've been in practice in Champaign, Illinois, I just do not see cases of pregnant moms with listeria. But they say that sliced delicatessen meats and cheeses actually have a little bit more risk. I always was taught that it was unpasteurized kind of foods like goat cheeses. And in Mexico, you can actually get unpasteurized milk. You can't get that here. Hmm. But that's important. And, of course, to reduce your chance of neural tube defects, you need folic acid supplementation. So that's very, very important. And in terms of conceiving, we usually say that about 80% of patients are pregnant after the first year of trying. So it's a good idea to go in and get some testing before you do try to get pregnant. And the typical tests that we recommend, other than reviewing your medical history and your diet history and getting you started on vitamins, are some basic blood tests to see if you're still immune to rubella. If you are a cat owner, we test you to see if you've ever been exposed to toxoplasmosis. If you've never had chicken pox, you might want to consider getting a varicella vaccine. We do test patients that are planning pregnancy for hepatitis, and there are a couple of forms of that that you can be vaccinated against, the A and the B. And we screen for HIV, again, not a significant factor in our community, but in others there is. And then in terms of genetic studies, if you have any family background of genetic diseases, then we recommend testing in individuals of Mediterranean descent or African American descent. We sometimes do hemoglobin electrophoresis that can look for causes of anemia. If you have a Jewish background, they test you for Tay-Sachs disease and Canavan's disease. And any Caucasians should probably be screened for cystic fibrosis, but other groups could consider being screened as well. Okay. So those are some basic tests.
All right. Well, again, if questions, people are listening who have questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455, and toll free 800-222-9455. Actually, there was something that I was thinking about asking you about that has also been in the news recently that I'm kind of confused about, and that is the controversy over the silicone breast implant. And just recently, there were some hearings in Washington, and apparently that one manufacturer or some manufacturers of silicone breast implants would like them again to be available for women, not just for anyone, but they want to, I think the idea is they were going to make them available to women that were having reconstructive surgery, women who had breast cancer and having reconstruction. And that if simply enhancement was what you were looking for, then still there is the saline implant. That's the one. That's the only one. And perhaps people will remember back some years back, there were concerns that the silicone implants were leaking and that some women were saying that they thought they had very serious adverse health effects. Now, I guess there's some question about that. But the thing that confused me was I in some of the reporting that I read, it made it sound like in the intervening period here, if you were having a reconstruction, you still could have gotten a silicone implant. And is that
Yes.
Is that right?
Well, okay. The whole silicone implant story is so confusing. Silicone was first used to enhance women's breasts back, decades and decades and decades ago. I believe it was mostly in the Orient. I believe it was mostly Japan, but I haven't looked over this information for a really long time. And they actually took silicone and injected it into individuals' breasts. Mm-hmm. It wasn't encapsulated at all. And breast tissue being sort of like a mesh did not contain this silicone. And this silicone kind of went everywhere. And it's not too difficult to imagine that this was not healthy for many individuals. Then came the era of silicone encapsulated in some sort of capsule. And that was also, these capsules over time would harden. They'd get a little bit brittle, like you can imagine, you know, if a piece of bread could be soft, but you leave it out long enough, it gets hard. And that brittleness led to possibilities of bubbling or microscopic little cracks or fractures. But actually, very few ever actually broke. And there's much better material technology now so that we can develop things that are even much less likely to leak. And so we came into an era where many people worldwide had these silicone implants, and some of them were getting mammograms and getting their implants ruptured, although that's infrequent. And I want to say right here, if you have an implant, go get a mammogram. Don't skip it. Much more important to find out if you have breast cancer than if you rupture your implant. But we had those situations, or just situations of leaking over time. Then there came a few what we call case reports. Women who happened to have a ruptured or leaking silicone implant who had some sort of other medical condition. And they were saying that this medical condition was related to the fact that they had a ruptured or leaking implant. And these medical conditions, many of them were generalized kinds of fatigue syndromes or arthritic syndromes. There were a number of things attributed. And so the question was, are these two things linked? Or did it just happen to be that a few people that had these, you know, were no difference in the population than people who didn't have implants? Unfortunately, before the long-term randomized prospective studies could be done, ruling in or out the linkage between these two things, the court cases ensued. And the court cases were such that the available silicone implants were taken off the market for cosmetic purposes. Many people received settlements and led to a lot of confusion and perhaps on the part of the medical field, some bad feelings that due process wasn't really served because we didn't have the studies that we could rely on. And many of the studies have subsequently come out and said these diseases are not linked to ruptured implants. Not that ruptured implants should be tolerated per se, but the way it was all handled. And silicone implants were completely replaced by the use of saline implants. And basically, if you were getting an implant for cosmetic purposes and it was in the United States, you had to get a saline one. And that's sort of been that. If, in fact, you had breast cancer or reconstructive surgery or something like that, there were ways you could apply to be exempt from this prohibition and get a silicone implant. And it's not my direct field, and I don't know how many women receive such implants or how easy or hard that was. But a few, it was almost like getting it on study. They really followed you very closely, and it was certain physicians and certain prescribed situations. So there have been some silicone implants. And now companies are coming out with an even better product, and they're going to the FDA, and they're saying, hey, these prospective studies have been done. These things that were attributed to silicone implants were falsely attributed, and that, yes, there were settlements and court cases, but that that doesn't necessarily pertain to our products, and they're trying to get them back, essentially.
Yeah, and it sounds like, as I said initially, what they're doing is they're asking for just for not for cosmetic purposes, but for the women who are having reconstruction post cancer. And I suppose if you're going to be cynical, that you're going to say, well, what they're hoping to do is establish again a track record of safety with this one patient population, so that sometime in the future they can go back to the FDA and say, see, these women have gotten the silicone implants. There's no problem with them. Now you ought to make them generally available for
right.
anyone,
right.
for even for those who wanted them for cosmetic reasons.
Well, and we've got a couple of different groups of patients out there. We still have women with silicone implants that are alive and well today that never got their silicone implants replaced by saline implants or removed. And so there is that population that we can follow. And in general, these silicone implants had some superiority relative to the look and feel of the saline ones, which is why people are interested in bringing them back.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we have a couple of callers here to talk with. Let us do that. And we'll start with Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I was fortunate to get pregnant right away when trying the first time around, and I didn't ever chart my cycles or find out how all of that worked until after I had my son. And I have been charting, and but kind of casually, and it seems like I have a short luteal phase, and all my friends who know much more about my planning than I do have told me, ooh, that's bad. And I don't know if there are some things that I should do to try to make my luteal phase longer or just wait and see how things turn out in trying to achieve a second pregnancy and worry about it then if it doesn't happen.
Well, excellent question. Just for our listeners who don't know what a short luteal phase is, we have a menstrual period, and that usually marks what's called day one of the cycle. And then the ovary begins to form an egg inside a small little cystic structure called a follicle. And the follicle's primary hormone production is estrogen. And then we get to the point where the follicle is so-called ripe or ready to ovulate, and a brain surge occurs of probably LH and FSH, and then that follicle ruptures open, releases the egg so it can go off and become pregnant and implant, and the follicle squishes down, and it reemerges in a new life cycle and becomes the corpus luteum. And one of the properties of the corpus luteum is to produce progesterone. And as long as a lot of progesterone is being produced, you will not shed the lining of the uterus. And once that egg implants, it sends signals to the corpus luteum to say, keep going, don't die off. And the corpus luteum keeps going and produces progesterone. Meanwhile, the new pregnancy forms a placenta. The placenta starts to make its own progesterone. And pretty soon there's a switch between the placental progesterone and the corpus luteum progesterone to support that lining and support that pregnancy. And that switch probably occurs somewhere between week 6 and week 10, depending on the pregnancy. So what happens in women who have a short luteal phase is not well understood, but the common thinking is that corpus luteum either never forms, and so very rapidly after ovulation, the uterus realizes there's no progesterone, no corpus luteum, and it just sheds and you have a menstrual period, or the corpus luteum forms, but it's weak and doesn't make a lot of progesterone, or it dies off early. So instead of having 14 days after ovulation during that luteal phase, you might only have 7 days or 10 days or 12 days, something like that. There are researchers who've made their entire infertility career on this short luteal phase. There are others that believe that women vary from cycle to cycle so much that an occasional short cycle is probably natural and doesn't need to be treated. So that most physicians who treat somebody in the early stages of trying to get pregnant tell you to just try for a while. And what's a while? Well, most insurance companies define that as 1 year. But a while would be defined differently depending on you and your physician. And then you can go to your physician and they have to make a determination. Was there something a little bit deficient about ovulation that didn't then turn into this good corpus luteum? Or was ovulation absolutely fine and you just need a little supplemental progesterone to lengthen out the amount of time that your body's provided with progesterone until a placenta could take over? A little bit technical. Hopefully you followed that. So the long and the short is that if you've got these calendars, you could sit down with your healthcare provider and say, how am I doing and what would you suggest? And that's probably on an individual basis the best next step.
Do you think there's a chance that my luteal phases were longer before my first pregnancy and I just didn't realize it and that's changed? Or do you think it's likely that I had short luteal phases before and still managed to get pregnant?
It's not really possible to say without knowing a lot more about you and your history, but it's possible that it's changed.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Let's go to someone here on a cell phone. This is our line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have a question. A very healthy 23-year-old triathlete, my daughter, who has developed ovarian cysts. And I wondered if you could address that topic of ovarian cysts and also any problem with her extreme workouts. So I think I should probably hang up and listen.
Okay. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Well, we look at the thing called the athlete triad, and athlete triads are people with extreme athletic activity who probably are extremely lean as a result of their activity or as a result of diet or some sort of combination, and also having menstrual cycle abnormalities. So we do worry about individuals in that athletic triad, and specifically we worry that their overall body estrogen is quite low and that we have to think in terms of protecting their bones. And I would probably, if I had somebody like that, I would check her calcium status. I would check her vitamin D status. I would monitor her bone health as closely as possible and probably do something to monitor whether she was, in fact, in a very low estrogen state, and probably recommend that she do something hormonally to have a period in some sort of regular intervals, and probably every 3 months is reasonable. It may or may not be relative to the individual case you cite of a triathlete who now has an ovarian cyst, because we think that many of the so-called simple cysts are formed from women who do ovulate and then, and I was just talking about the corpus luteum, and sometimes either the follicle doesn't release its egg and it just grows and becomes a big cyst, or it releases its egg and turns into a corpus luteum, which then doesn't dissolve when it's supposed to in a particular cycle, but it takes on extra fluid and it becomes a cyst. And those are called functional cysts, and those usually occur in ovulatory people. So that may or may not be related to the high physical activity. If she's in fact a typical athletic triad and not ovulating, then the cyst might be something else. And in young people, we think in terms of dermoid cysts, and dermoid cysts are kind of an egg gone crazy. Anything an egg can have, a dermoid cyst can have. So they can have hair and fat and teeth and be a little bit exotic, but they are virtually never, very rarely are they actually cancerous, but they are true cysts. They're not going to ever dissolve. They need to come out. Or she can have some sort of endometriosis and have a cyst of an endometrioma within her ovary. And in fact, that's never going to dissolve and needs to be removed. Or, of course, some cysts can be cancerous, but it's quite rare in the younger age groups and more common as individuals age. So for somebody who's a triathlete and has a cyst, she needs to work with her own healthcare provider and find out if these two things are in truth related or not.
Well, I hope that gets to the question of the caller. We have maybe 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus with Dr. Suzanne Troopin. And if you have a question, if someone wants to call in, if they can get in right away, I'm sure we can get one caller, maybe two in the time that remains. I think you have some other things that you thought we could talk about.
Well, and I was talking about nutrition, and I wanted to emphasize vitamin D and the importance in bone health and its relationship to your overall body calcium. And I think, as I said, I don't think I had a program last month, and I'm having a little trouble remembering exactly what I covered a couple of months ago. But with our location in the north, we do have to worry that we have inadequate vitamin D levels. And actually, vitamin D usually isn't something that we typically measure when we go to the doctor. If you said, "Doc, give me some basic blood work," the last thing they would probably think of is vitamin D level. But in fact, I've been doing a lot of measurements of vitamin D with my bone health studies. We have several research studies looking at new types of treatments of osteopenia and for the prevention of osteoporosis in menopausal women. And with those studies, I've been measuring a lot of vitamin D levels, and I've been a little bit surprised at how many of my patients, in fact, don't qualify for the studies because their vitamin D level is too low. And in patients who've had these bone density tests, I think we're moving more towards, don't just get that number and be told that it's borderline or low. You need probably a little bit more medical evaluation than that. You need a little bit of check on your calcium, a check on your vitamin D level. You possibly need other tests as well to make sure nothing medical is going on. And that's probably where the research is going. And then once you do get started on medication, there's a little bit more monitoring of that medicine that's going to go on. There's a brand new medication that is coming onto the market that will be able to be given once a month instead of once a week. And we're in testing for intravenous medications that you can use every 3 months or every year for treatment and prevention of osteoporosis. So actually, there's quite a bit going on there. But the first step is to get your nutrition in order, calcium, vitamin D.
Okay. We had a question here come in from someone who wanted to ask their question, didn't want to ask it on the air, but had a question about pap smears. And the caller was asking when's the best time to get it. And I guess we're kind of assuming that really what the caller is interested in, you know, who should get them, when should they get them, how often should they get them. Maybe you can run down what the basic recommendations is for pap smears.
Well, American Cancer Society has actually changed the recommendations in the past about year or so. And we now recommend the first pap smear by age 21 or within 3 years of becoming sexually active. So that's a change from age 18. If you're sexually active, we recommend that you get a pap smear once a year. If you have been mutually monogamous and have 3 negative pap smears, you might be somebody that could be triaged into getting pap smears every other year or even every third year. Over the age of 30, the FDA has now approved a test called the Pap Plus. So you're getting a pap smear plus an HPV test. And if you are somebody that has had negative Pap Plus tests and you are very low risk category, you could actually be triaged into getting fewer paps. Over the age of 70, patients who've had 3 negative pap smears, probably 3 negative pap plus, could be also triaged into every 2 to 3 year pap tests. And patients who have had hysterectomies and no precancerous conditions, then they could actually go into 3 negative tests and then be triaged to less frequent testing as well, and even abandoned testing post-hysterectomy. Now, many family practitioners, obstetrician, gynecologists, and other healthcare providers that do pap smears feel very reluctant to actually triage anybody into not getting their pap smear every year, since it's very difficult to keep track of every last risk factor in every patient. So we're still seeing a lot of once a year PAPs done, but this PAP plus the HPV will probably revolutionize PAP smear testing, and we will probably get an extremely better pickup rate of cancerous and precancerous changes, as well as allowing some patients to not get as frequent PAPs. Now, as soon as we talk about PAPs, I have to preface that by saying the pelvic exam is not the pap smear. They're 2 complementary tests. And if you still have a uterus, tubes, and ovaries, you need that pelvic exam every year, whether or not the pap smear is the component. And since patients link those so carefully, healthcare providers are very hesitant to say, don't get your pap, because they look at their patient and they can see her thinking, oh, no pelvic exam next year. And that's really not what we mean. So I think probably that's what the caller is trying to get at.
Okay. Well, I hope so. And again, if she wants to call back real quick, she can do that. Otherwise, we'll be here for another couple of minutes with Dr. Suzanne. Of those things that you brought with you, were there some things we still haven't done?
Well, I think at my last show, I talked about polycystic ovarian condition, and it's a fairly in-depth subject, and I won't be able to go into depth, but many women with menstrual irregularities over the years have been diagnosed with polycystic ovarian condition or polycystic ovarian syndrome or polycystic ovarian disease. It's gone by several different names, and usually these women have some sort of cycle abnormality plus some sort of hormone abnormality. And the quick fix for many physicians has been to place patients on birth control pills. But many patients are reluctant to take hormones or possibly even trying to get pregnant. And I think on my last show that I did, we talked about a new weight loss medicine called Orlistat that can be used to reduce your hormone levels. We've also in past shows talked about a water pill that can be used to straighten out your periods. And now also they've done a research study on the statins that lower your cholesterol, and it actually can improve your hormone. And so I'm very anxious to tell patients that there are a lot of new treatments for women who do have irregular menstrual cycles, particularly women who skip their periods. And we're involved in the testing of some of that with hormones, but there are quite a few treatments without hormones as well.
Okay. We did get a call back from our caller who had the question about the pap smear, and she did have one further question, and that essentially I think she's asking, is there a particular time in your monthly cycle
where
you
I'm
would
sorry.
Suggest, is there one time of the month, or does it not particularly?
You don't want to get your pap smear ideally when you're on your menstrual period, and we actually request that patients abstain from intercourse for 2 days prior to getting their pap smear, and that increases the chances that that pap smear will be accurate. Now, there are many new technologies for pap smears. There are some of these liquid-based paps, and I'm also involved in a testing of a new one of those. And I think that we have seen increased accuracy for our patients, even if they're not at the most optimal time for getting their pap smear test.
All right, good. Well, I hope that answers the question. I want to thank everybody who called in with their questions this morning. I think there we'll wrap it up for this time around with the promise that next month Dr. Troopin will be back and we will do it again. Thanks very
thank
much.
You.
Dr. Suzanne Troopin, she is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She has practice here in our area. She teaches at the U of I Med School once each month on the program on a Monday. She is here and we talk about women's health. Programming here on WILL made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Watch for your Krannert Center 2005-2006 season brochure the first week of May and visit KrannertCenter.com for the most current Krannert Center news. The program is also made possible with support from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. Coming up a little bit later today as part of the afternoon magazine, we'll have a look at Islam through the eyes of an American Muslim woman, a journalist Asra Nomani. She's the author of a book titled Standing Alone in Mecca, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. She calls the book a manifesto of the rights of women based on the true faith of Islam. She says it heralds a revolution in the Muslim world of the 21st century. And she will be talking with Celeste Quinn in the 1 o'clock hour of the afternoon magazine today. The program itself gets underway at noon with the usual mix of news, sports, weather, and other things. Again, Celeste Quinn, the host for the show. Coming up in the next part of this program, we'll be talking about a controversial subject, to say the least, and that is same-sex marriage. Our guest will be Richard Moore. He's professor of philosophy at the University of Illinois, who's written a lot about the issue of equality when it comes to lesbian and gay Americans. And he's got a new book out that's titled The Long Arc of Justice that deals specifically with the issue of lesbian and gay marriage. We'll talk about that in the next hour, so hope you can stick around. Coming up here just very shortly, we'll have news from National Public Radio. Before that, an update on the markets, so stay tuned.
And a reminder, it's also time to take your old jazz albums off the shelf, get easy listening CDs out of the closet, box up your unused stereo equipment, donate them to Vintage Vinyl. Drop-off sites are now accepting your donations of records, CDs, videos, and DVDs. If you have working stereo,